We had a delightful song service in Youngstown this morning. Jimmy and Lily Guy's brother and his wife and their little baby have been visiting them for a while. And William Miller led songs. It was nice to see him again. Hadn't seen him, I think, since he was a teenager at camp in California. So it was good to get to see them during these spring holy days. And I can see that George is in fine form with lots of energy, which certainly livens up our song service. That's really good. We like that. Okay, now another subject. We'll shift over to the sermon. Have you noticed the palpable increase of emotional tension in the nation and the world over the last 2 years, especially the last 12 months? Now, you'll see during the year, you'll see rises of tension and lowering of tension. Normally, when you track where things seem to be more tense than others, if you're paying attention to the news, you'll notice the tenseness and the rhetoric and that kind of thing. It was a little tense this morning, I think, in Syria and in Russia, too, because they have howled but don't have, I don't think, much that they will try to do in this regard. With the bombing of the Syria's military installations, especially those that may have to do with that poisonous gas incident. But the tension increases at times like that. It increases at times of sometimes elections, controversy, and we've had a fairly high tension situation ever since the presidential election, and not just caused by the president by any means. In fact, probably more of it was caused by the other side. I haven't seen it this agitated since probably the late 1960s, maybe the early 70s a little bit. And you have to make your own judgment on that as you think back the things that were going on then. 1968, of course, was the anti-war demonstrations and riots in the big cities and riots on all the college campuses, and they basically shut down the Democratic National Convention for choosing candidate for president down in Chicago that year. It was a explosive year. And if I'm not mistaken, Martin Luther King was assassinated that year, and so was Bobby Kennedy. I'm pretty sure that was the year that they both lost their lives. But that was a tense time. There were other tense times. It came on into the early 1970s as well. But it hasn't been as tense very often since then. Right now it's more tense. The tensions are rising. The geopolitics are taking place around the world. China is trying to flex their muscle, while Russia, which doesn't have the muscle that had the Soviet Union, is trying to flex its muscle. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have any, but it doesn't have what it had in those days. Europe is fishtailing around. Most of it's kind of dawdling. But it was interesting that France and England responded to the U.S. initiative to bomb those poisonous gas plants in Syria, which was not unusual because here we have three Israelite originated nations responding in kind, or responding in concert, shall we say. Concert's what I meant for that. But all the same, it increases the tensions. And so we see that. Now, it may drop a little bit as time goes by. It just depends on what's coming down the line in the news. But I've observed, and you have too, the liberal and conservative parties, because that's what they have turned out into the past several decades that we have in America. We don't call them the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. They do that in England and a couple of other nations, but we don't here. We have other names for them, but still they stand for those things. But I've noticed that the intensity has increased quite dramatically. They've been at each other, but again, the comparison of rhetoric in comparing the two, it seems that the Liberal Party has sort of lost control, has gone, I don't know, not completely control, but they have really amped up their yelling and hollering and their being all shocked. It's what happens. Most people aren't really shocked at all because it's not surprising. Over the decades when the conservative movement has lost political battles, it tended to lick its wounds and then reenter the arena of ideas again. But it doesn't seem to be happening that way with the liberal movement. They got licked, shall we say, in the election last year. Right now, they scream and yell and howl in anger, and they don't have any residual sense of fair play. I've been seeing that erode ever since the baby boomers were demonstrating at the college campuses in the 1960s. A sense of fair play. And you wonder, why is it? Why can't they act more mature than they do? You know, they have their victories at times in politics. They have their defeats at times. Why can't they take one with the other? And my analysis is, having grown up in that generation that's making all that noise, or that's leading the making of that noise, is that they don't have any inner peace. They are not happy people. I mean, they're not calm inside, particularly at all. They communicate mainly by yelling and scowling and snarling, and they've always done that. Going back to the demonstrations at the college campuses in 68, 50 years ago this year, they've gotten good at it. Well, if you can call that getting good. Why don't they have any inner peace? And I think the answer is this. It's in Romans 8 and verse 6. You can make a note of that. Romans 8 and verse 6. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. All right. They're carnally minded. They are not converted. They don't have God's Spirit. All of, you know, basically, most of the nation is. I mean, the vast majority of it is carnally minded. But some have a residual influence of the Scriptures and of the knowledge of God's existence. Others have repudiated anything to do with Scripture and even anything to do with even the idea that there is a God. And that's the liberals' heritage. They excel at atheism, antagonistic, angry atheism. That's no surprise to not have something greater than themselves to worship. You're going to get frustrated. And you don't have any way to process the anger, so you get more and more angry. It's very interesting, looking back just a few years for us, the Pacific Northwest has been in the forefront of that baby boomer protest culture for a long time, and they've recruited other protesters. We didn't really notice how they did that. I'll explain that in a minute. Well, when we lived in Eugene, Oregon, we were there in Eugene and the town south of it for 14 years. We watched what was happening in the area. That's when the leftist movement in America started having riots against the World Trade Organization, and they would tear up the town, whatever city the trade organ WTO had as their big meeting. They would tear the city apart or try to. They started, of all things, with Seattle, which is one of their places, but they didn't seem to care. That had in its residual impact through more and more riots. This would have been in the not so much the late 90s as, well, yes, the late 90s early into the early 2000s. We had a city policeman who was our next-door neighbor and good friend, and they got caught off guard in, you know, it's not a big town, maybe 250,000 people if you take in the surrounding area. But they hadn't had to deal with riots since the 60s there. But now they had riots. So they trained their police force how to work a riot. And you never find out how you work a riot. You have a team behind shields, and they're basically armored, helmets on. They don't go in with their guns. They wear them, but they aren't going to go shooting at people. They use billy clubs if they need to, but mostly they just are going after the ringleaders. And so behind them, like a quarterback, is one of their bosses who is trained in identifying the ringleaders in the crowd of protesters. And when he spotted one, he will then tell the troop of policemen ahead of him, go get that one. And they will charge the crowd, shoving them aside with their shields, grab that guy, snatch him behind, or gal, as the case might be, behind the shield wall, and handcuff him, get him in the paddy wagon, and stand ready to go after the next one. And they can rapidly de-escalate a riot by doing that. Because the average person in a riot is there because of something to do. You know, and not because it is what their belief is, and not because they're being paid to be there. A lot of those rioters and protesters are hired to be protesters. Amanda found that out. She can tell you the story, but they would recruit them at the University of Oregon. The actual rioters or riot sponsors or riots, Riot Inc., I guess you could call it, would come to the universities and try to recruit liberal students to become professional rioters and protesters, and then they would train them how to do it, which explained to us, because we'd wondered for a number of years why we would see when they were demonstrating, they didn't have anything political to argue about, so they were angry at people who killed trees. Because after all, trees are bigger than yourself, and so you can't cut a tree down. That seems funny back here because they didn't get back here to do that. Back there, that was a big deal. And they would go and destroy logging companies' equipment, pouring gas into fuel tanks and doing all kinds of things to sabotage the killing of these trees that they love to worship. But they would we would see the same faces when we saw news coverage of a riot in the woods in Northern California. And then in Oregon, I said, what? Those two or three, they look just like the same ones we saw yesterday or the week before. Or up in Washington, you'd see the coverage again. You'd see faces that look very, very familiar. Well, that's because they were the pros that were in there calling the shots and stirring up the locals. Now, that's a part of that particular movement. They don't have any inner peace. They don't have any great value system that is greater than them except for tall trees. Now, since they decry any sort of existence of God, they cut themselves off from even a modicum of spiritual peace, even just at least a little bit. But there is one primary ingredient to the true inner spiritual peace they don't have, and that's what we're going to get to, the inner peace that they don't have and why they don't have it. Why do we have godly peace in following God's way? And sometimes why do we have too little of it? Where we're upset and anxious and maybe angry and not really knowing why we're angry. Now, we need to take seriously the fact that from Ephesians chapter 2, and let you read that on your own this week, Satan broadcasts moods and attitudes. And we've known that for a long time. I think that was one of the brilliant deductions that Herbert Armstrong made in analyzing the way the world was going during the 20th century. Now, Satan broadcasts in moods and attitudes. Prince of the power of the air is in that passage. We need to have a godly peace of mind to combat this influence of the society around us. We need to have, brethren, true inner peace. Godly peace of mind is a title. A godly peace of mind. This is beyond just regular peace of mind. The average person might have some because of the family that they grew up in and the culture that they lived in locally and so on. This is a peace of mind that literally comes from God. That's what we want to have. So the key word is peace, because you can't have peace of mind if you don't have peace. You might get a piece of somebody's mind, but it won't be the right kind of peace. We want a peace, God's peace of mind. So let's do just a review of some select scriptures on no particular order except that they follow each other in the book, starting in Numbers chapter 6. These are some scriptures about peace. Gives us a sense of what God is talking about when he talks about peace that leads to that godly peace of mind. And then we'll analyze one of the particular ones as well, and then summarize and tie that all together as a method for us to develop peace of mind. And you think, well, how do I develop peace of mind? You know, if you want to develop a muscle, what do? Jumping jacks or some kind of exercise. But if you want to develop peace of mind, what do? If you want to be angry, you could yell a lot. You could practice yelling. I think the problem is probably what you learn in Protester 101 when you go to their protest schools. Yell and snarl and look mean, but when you want to have inner peace, you know, God's peace, what do to practice? Well, this is what you do to practice. You study and think, and then it starts to rub off on us. Numbers chapter 6. Now, This is what we're going to is right at the end of the chapter. It starts in verse 22. This is sometimes called the Aaronic blessing. In other words, named after Aaron, who was the high priest. But it is a specific blessing that God, he didn't inspire it. He dictated it to Moses to be written down. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron, in verse 22, and his sons. So it is what the priests would recite. That would be their job to recite this over the congregations of Israel or the gatherings of the congregations of Israel for the smaller ones. Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. So how do you bless the children of Israel? Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. What does that mean? You have a shiny face. We get a shiny face when we, you know, get hot and sweaty and the face gets kind of shiny. But the shining of the face is a reflection of light. And when you want to have a shiny face, you sort of look up at the sky and your face will be lighter. But if the sun's out, it'll be shiny. And so you get a shiny face from the light. And likewise, from spiritual light, you get an inner shiny face, if you will. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift his countenance upon you and give you peace. Give you peace. So this is a blessing of peace, a peaceful spirit, a peaceful attitude, a peaceful life generally, but especially the peace that is within. You noticed, if anybody was looking up here, I was holding one of my hands like this. Okay, this is a tricky detail. That's the Live Long and Prosper from Vulcan in Star Trek. Leonard Nimoy was a Jewish kid. Well, he grew up as a Jewish man, but he started as a Jewish kid and attended synagogue with his family. And on the high holy service was over, he said that then some of the men and the older boys would go into the rooms, side rooms off the main meeting room, and they would put on a robe over their suits. And then they would come out and they would bless the congregation and recite this passage and hold their hands like this. Now, as a little boy, this was a prayer, so the little boy is supposed to keep his head bowed contritely, but he turned his head sideways and opened one eye and he saw what they were doing, and so he remembered that. And he was on the, when Star Trek, which was, you know, groundbreaking sci-fi filming back in the 1960s, they did a pilot, which I never saw until later, but in the pilot, he was a Vulcan, played basically the role that he played, but he didn't have pointed ears. And so he came up with the idea of the pointed ears for the Vulcans, and then he added this in. So this was the Vulcan greeting, you know, live long and prosper, which is essentially the summary of what God is saying here, the ultimate prospering being the spiritual prospering. A little trivia, but it adds a little interest to it. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. This is where our peace comes from, that inner peace that we seek. And when we don't have it, we are at loose ends because we're meant to have it. We are God's people. We've been called out of a world that doesn't understand the way to peace. Some have a little inkling. Some go to the scriptures and read it, and that carries a positive influence. But most don't have it. They live in a rat race life. We know, because we have to live out in the rat race itself. But we have something going for us that we must never underestimate. God has given us his peace as a great blessing. But we need to develop it and to use it, or it doesn't do us much good. Let's turn to Psalm 34. Peace is either a major theme or a sub-theme in many of the Psalms. I'll do a selection here. Well, this will be one of them. Psalm 34. This is one of David's psalms. David was often in trouble. He wrote psalms when he was in trouble. Sometimes, you know, he was a brave, strong man and a great warrior and all that sort of thing. But he seemed to get terrified sometimes with the trouble that he was in. It was overwhelming for him. The King Saul, who he had been defending, didn't like him and kept throwing spears at him. So he finally had to quit his musical job there at the throne room and get out of range. And then Saul brought the army to try to track him down. He was a wanted man. All the while, he is trying to stay out of Saul's way, and he's trying to defend the borders of Israel from other invaders that Saul isn't defending against. So David's words, as God worked through his own, David's words, and inspired right through those, he talked about fierce witnesses rise up, and they ask me things I do not know. They reward me evil for good. Saul certainly did, to the sorrow of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth and ashes. And I'm in chapter 3, in Psalm 35. I need to be in 34. All right. But actually, it made the point that I was talking about David. Let's drop down to Psalm 34. And here we want to read from 11 on down. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you with the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Most all of us do. Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. In other words, be honest. Speak honestly. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Or as we sing that hymn or one of the Psalms very similar to it, seek peace, pursue it earnestly. That's how Mr. Dwight Armstrong put that into a lyric to carry the concept of earnestness and sincerity and depth of feeling. Seek peace and pursue it earnestly. Peace doesn't come, just coming over to our house and plopping down and here I am. Now, we have to seek it. We have to find it. We have to bring it home. We have to give it ice cream and tea and have it stay. That's what we have to do with peace. Psalm 120. When you have this peace, life is much better. Let me make sure I'm in the right psalm this time. Yep, I am. First seven verses. Oh, hold it. It's the last seven verses. Psalm 120 is a song of ascent. You can see it there. If you have usually in your superscription, the superscription is just before the first verse starts, normally placed in smaller print. That's actually part of the inspired record. It's identifying what kind of a psalm it is. A song of ascent was the songs that the Israelites, when they were going up to Jerusalem to keep the feast or keep the Passover and unleavened bread, they would sing these songs in their final ascent to Jerusalem, because wherever they lived, whether down by the Dead Sea or up in the mountains where Nazareth was, for example, it was higher than Jerusalem elevation-wise, but they would come to Jerusalem. Those from the Dead Sea just was up, 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 and up, about 3,000 or 3,500 feet to get there. But from Nazareth, you would come down and to a dip in the elevation of the nation, and then you would start up to Jerusalem. And it was when you were going up, when you were ascending. Thus, the songs of ascent were that final approach to Jerusalem. So they would sing these. They start right here. This is the very first one. Psalm 120. In my distress I cried to the Lord, and he's heard me. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. We cry to God. God hears us. We need to be delivered. Lips are we delivered from? Sometimes it's other people's. Mostly it's our own, a deceitful tongue. What shall be given to you, or what shall be done to you, you false tongue? Sharp arrows of the warrior with coals of the broom tree. That's what you're like. You don't want to run into a sharp arrow. Dull arrows are a real pain too, but sharp arrows are much worse. And you don't want any coals around the broom tree. Burns it right up. Woe is me that I dwell in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. My soul has dwelt too long with one who hates peace. We don't want to be too long dwelling with one who hates peace, because it rubs off. unless it's already us, the one that hate peace. Then it doesn't have to rub off. It's already there. You know, it's internal. We want to root it out. I am for peace. This is our verse. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. We want to be for peace, inner peace that comes out in peaceful words toward others, loving words and kind, obedient words to God. That's the kind of peace that we want. Across the page in Psalm 122, another song of ascent. Psalm 122. I'm going to read the whole thing because it's just such a beautiful psalm. I was glad when they said to me, let us go up to the house of the Eternal. Our feet have been standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. So we're going up to the house of the Eternal, up to keep the feast. Then we're standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is built, the city that is compact together, where the tribes go up. Again, this is part of the reason why it's called Songs of Ascent. The tribes of the Lord, meaning the Israelites, the testimony of Israel, to give thanks to the name of the Lord, for thrones are set there, for judgment and thrones of the house of David. Then we get this peace. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem, that they may prosper who love you. Peace be within your walls, Jerusalem. Peace within your walls. Prosperity within your palaces. For the sake of my brethren and companions, I will now say, peace be within you. Peace be within you. We want to have peace without, in our interchanges with each other, our friendships and fellowship, and generally with people. But it can't be thriving unless the peace is inside. We have to be at peace. And that's the challenge, brethren, how to get the peace inside. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. The peace be within you. The way you study these psalms is not in the way of proving this doctrine or that doctrine, although incidentally you will here and there. You study these psalms by reading them and thinking about them. They are written for mankind for all time. You know, well, how would they know what we're going through now? They didn't have to. What we're doing with the lives we live now are just merely lived faster than they did. We drive and fly. They walk and ride. We have, you know, a few different things in the culture, but human nature is the same no matter when it is, Garden of Eden or now. So there's a commonality, and thus we can study these words, and they have a calming effect upon us. That's a part of developing the peace within, is to study the passages that talk about peace and let it sink in. Now, and it says in verse 6, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Don't forget that in the New Testament we are called the Jerusalem above, which is the mother of us all, is a description of the church of God. So that's a reference. Jerusalem can easily be a reference and, in fact, is a type of God's true church. Now we go another page or two, still in the Songs of Ascent, in Psalm 125. Psalm 125. Again, we'll go through it because it's all of five verses long. Those who trust in the Eternal are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. As mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forever. See, as you're walking up to the feast, you're seeing the other mountains around. And one of the mountains around is the Mount of Olives. It's not exactly a mountain peak. It's more of a high ridge that goes up and then down again. It's immediately east of Jerusalem. That's one of the mountains of Jerusalem. And you see that when you're on the mountain of the Temple Mount, you can turn around and look east, and you're looking at the Mount of Olives. It's 100 feet higher than the highest part of Jerusalem. Thus, you see these photographs of where the Temple Mount is and presently is inhabited by the Dome of the Rock, also known as the Shrine of Omar, or the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is a few yards from it, a very famous mosque in Islam. You're looking down at it, and you get this golden glow of light, and you wonder, how do they get that beautiful golden, you know, hue to everything? Well, that's easy. They're standing on a Mount of Olives at sunrise. And so the sun's shooting, coming down over the shoulder of the photographer, and when the sun shines through a lot of the atmosphere, it throws a golden sort of pale to everything or golden hue to everything. I was surprised to find out how golden it can be. Several years ago, or a couple of years ago, we were up in Canmore, Alberta for the feast. Had a little tiny condominium about right next door, very conveniently to the hall we were using for the feast meetings. And one morning I got up early. Linda's brother Terry was up and having a cup of coffee, and I was looking out the window because we're on a bit of a hill and was on the second floor. That's where we were. And Canmore is a ski resort area, and when you stand anywhere in the town and just turn in a circle, all you can see are snow-capped peaks. And you wonder, how did they get in here? Well, there's a pass. You come through. That's how you get in there. But it's beautiful snow-capped peaks, and it was just at sunrise, and the sun was just breaking over the mountains behind us and hitting the Three Sisters, which is a big ridge with three massive peaks, and several other peaks that were over in that vicinity on that side of the city, and it was throwing gold right at the top of them, so they looked like golden volcanoes. Well, one of them looked like a volcano. The others just looked like golden mountains. I mean, just as gold. It's on my phone, and I could show it to you, provided that my phone hasn't, deleted them or something. You know, that's how we go. We carry it around on our phone and look at it, and then the phone goes kaput, and there goes all those pictures. I don't want to lose my golden mountains. I'm going to print those pictures sometime. But it's a spectacular, beautiful setting of the feast, and the mountains of Jerusalem are kind of like that. They're golden in a spiritual sense and spectacular in that sense. So here we are. We look at that again in verse 5 is what we're coming down to. Verse 3, for the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land allotted to the righteous, lest the righteous reach out their hands to iniquity. God's not going to let evil be in his kingdom. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good, and to those who are upright in their hearts, those who choose your way, in other words. And now we come to the final verse. As for such as turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead them away with the workers of iniquity. And we know that he will. It's called the lake of fire. And it's an end. It's not a torture forever. It's an end. But it's the final line of verse 5. Peace be upon Israel. Peace be upon Israel. And it's similar to what we read back in Numbers. Peace be upon Israel. You think, well, that's true. Israel is a type of all the rest of the nations. God's plan started with Israel, and it was going to extend out. In the New Testament era, God's plan starts with his church, which is spiritual Israel. So this is a prayer as easily for the church as it was for ancient Israel at the time. A prayer and a song. Peace be upon Israel. Or if you'll turn to Galatians chapter 6, just briefly here, we'll be back in the Old Testament in a minute. Galatians 6. Spiritual Israel has another descriptor, another way of phrasing it. Here we are. Now we have to lead up to capture the sense of what is being said here. Notice what Paul is signing off his letter, and either he wrote the entire letter himself, or somebody, he dictated it to a scribe who wrote it, and then he wrote the last bit here. We aren't sure which it was. Paul was very myopic. He had nearsighted. He didn't have good vision at all. Now, he may have had in his younger days, but remember, he was struck down on the way to Damascus when he was going there to arrest more church members and drag them back to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 9. Go back and read that story. It's a good story to read. God struck him blind. He was blind for 3 days. We don't know what his vision was before that. But we do know his vision after that was not good because he comments about it regularly. See with what large letters I have written to you with my own hand. In order to see what he's writing, he has to write it very large. And if you remember back when Mr. Herbert Armstrong was still alive, he had the giant typewriter, a special one that, made really, really large letters so he could see them because of his failing eyesight. He was still doing broadcasting or telecasting, and even with the giant print on the page, he had a big magnifying glass for it so he could read it. Well, Paul was in a similar boat. Again, I don't know how long that had happened to Paul, but he is showing the brethren in Galatia, which is the center of Turkey today. I don't think any of the ancient Galatians still live there, but whatever the case, that's where he, where Galatia was. See with what large letters I have written to you with my own hand. As many as desire to make a good showing in the flesh, these would compel you to be circumcised, only that they might not suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. So they had a heresy in the church. Ooh, what do you know? We've had that before in our modern time too. That, in fact, the apostles were wrong, and all the men who are Gentiles have to be circumcised in order to be converted. Well, that's false doctrine. The doctrine was set to a great extent through the apostle Paul and Barnabas, the two of them, who reported to the council of Acts chapter 15. The council was the apostles. The other elders gathered as well, but the apostles were chairing. That would be their job, to chair that council. And Christ was making it very clear through them that men who were Gentiles did not have to be circumcised in order to receive God's Spirit. But now there was a heresy developing. It was sort of a messianic Jewish heresy, which is also plagues the church today, doesn't it? But that was the version of it then. Oh, yeah, you have to be circumcised, or your conversion, your baptism doesn't count. And Paul is taking them on. One thing the Apostle Paul was feisty. And he would defend, bulldog feisty. He would defend the faith and the brethren, so that they won't suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. Verse 13, for not even those who are circumcised keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised so that they may boast in your flesh. But God forbid that I should boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. You know, Paul's invested the rest of his life from the time he was converted into promoting the true gospel. Verse 15, for in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision avails anything, but a new creation. The circumcision had a purpose in ancient Israel. In the New Testament era, with the spiritual conversion of the brethren, it doesn't serve that purpose. It doesn't have to, it isn't used for that purpose. The identifier of those who are in the spiritual Israel, that is the church of God, the identifier is conversion, the presence of God's Spirit in the mind. Ancient Israel didn't have that, except for a tiny few, certain prophets, certain kings, not all the kings by any means, some of the judges. Very few had God's Spirit in the Old Testament. Their day will come. We'll see them in the great white throne judgment, and then they'll understand. And as many as walk according to this rule, verse 16, peace and mercy be upon them. You know, those who are in agreement with the teaching of the Bible and of the church, as the church came to understand what the Bible was teaching, they walk according to that rule. Well, peace and mercy be upon them and upon, note this, the Israel of God. And upon the Israel of God. See, that scripture is why we refer to the church as spiritual Israel. Now, there are lots of other supporting scriptures, but that's a critical one right there. The Israel of God. In reference to the church. He's talking about the church and uses the term the Israel of God. So when we go back into the Psalms and we read, peace be upon Israel, it is direct application, pulling it forward to us today, the church today, and the church down through time, small as it has been, beleaguered and persecuted as it has been. You know, this is a review of what true peace is and how it works. Let's go to and look at Isaiah 9 now. We'll go back into the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 9. This is one of the names of Christ. In one of the most beautiful prophecies about Christ, and George Frederick Handel considered it beautiful too. This is from the oratorio called The Messiah, and it's one most of us are familiar with. Very beautiful singing if you have good singers singing it. usually gets played on Christmas Eve. It has nothing to do with Christmas Eve at all. In fact, Handel was from Germany, and when he was commissioned by the Anglican Church to produce an oratorio about Christ, he came over to England, and then they said, "And we would be happy to help you with, you know, with the prophecies and the scriptures." And he says, "Thank you, but I read the Bible myself," which is probably why it doesn't sound like an Anglican hymn. It actually has, you know, more the sound of what the scripture says, because it does. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder." Now, we understand that. The son is given, the child is born, and then there's a semicolon. There are over 2,000 years in that semicolon. "And the government will be upon his shoulder." The first two lines are about the first coming of Christ. The next two lines are about the second coming of Christ. "And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor," or "Wonderful Counselor," one or the other, "Mighty God, Everlasting Father," and it's the last name, "Prince of Peace." Christ is the Prince of Peace. When we feel agitated, we need to remember that our Savior is the Prince of Peace, and is happy to share that peace with us. Chapter 26, Isaiah has a couple more things for us. Isaiah 26. So we'll start right at the beginning, verse 1. Verse 3 is our target. We may run past it a little bit, but we'll start at the beginning. In verse 1, in that day this song shall be sung in the land of Judah. In what day? In that day is a phrase that when you put them together, they're similar ones. Time to come, in that day, and so on. We're looking forward to when the kingdom of God is on the earth, either the millennium or the white throne judgment. In that day. And then there'll be even a fulfillment, the ultimate eternal fulfillment with the new earth, the new heavens, and new Jerusalem, and so on. "We have a strong city." This is the song will be sung in the land of Judah. "We have a strong city. God will appoint salvation for walls and bulwarks. Open the gates, and the righteous nation that keeps the truth may enter in. You will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you." You will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you. Our brethren, are our minds stayed on God? And I think we know how the use of the word "stayed" is there. Are they locked in on what God is and who God is and what he is and what he's like, so that we can be like that too? Our minds need to be stayed on God, so that we can gather and so we can exude ultimately that perfect peace. Not agitated, not angry, not always concerned about ourselves, concerned about others. Because he trusts in you, trust in the eternal forever, for in Yah, the eternal, is the everlasting strength. But in him is that perfect peace. For those who truly follow God, we want to have that perfect peace. And it is there for us to have. It's in this hymn that's mentioned there in italics to fill in the sense of the sentence in English. It can be in us. We can have that perfect peace. Beyond, which is in addition to our initial conversion and receiving of God's Spirit, we build increased levels of peace. If we're not building peace in our years in the church and in the true faith, then what are we building? War? Agitation? Frustration? Anger? We need to build peace. And when we build peace, we can take in stride what God has for us to go through. We can help those who are in need of understanding God's way better. We can encourage and strengthen each other even more. When we're at peace, when we're at war, we don't help each other at all. We fracture the congregation. We don't want that. We want to pull very tightly together to be God's people. So Christ is the Prince of Peace, and God will keep the righteous in a perfect peace. Notice Isaiah 59, the world doesn't have that peace. Isaiah 59. Let's go and see a contrast here for a minute. Give you just a sense of what Isaiah 59 is about. Look at verses 14 and 15, talking about the world today. Justice is turned back, and righteousness stands afar off. For truth has fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. So truth fails, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. And that's what the world is like. So now we go back to the earlier part of the chapter, and we look at another aspect. In verse 4, no one calls for justice. And in our world, they aren't calling for justice. They're calling for how much can I get away with? And what can I get out of this? Who can I destroy the reputation of? Nor does any plead for truth. We have our political party, the one we talked about, especially pleading for truth. I think not. They trust in empty words and speak lies. And they do it very angrily over the past year or two. I mean, an intensity of anger beyond what was before. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. They hatch vipers' eggs and weave spiders' webs. You know what happens when you hatch vipers' eggs? You get baby snakes. You like baby snakes? Nope, most people don't. Most of us don't like snakes very much at all. Rattlesnakes, just in case you're interested, hatch their eggs inside their bodies, and then they give birth to the baby snakes. But the eggs are retained in the body until they hatch. I found that out when I was skinning one time. Suddenly there were baby snakes everywhere. And my brother and I jumped back a little bit to try to figure out what had happened, and then we finally remembered, oh, yeah, biology class. Mr. So-and-so told us about it. Yeah, I should know that. I wrote a rattlesnake research paper at the time. So then we had to study it. But you break the viper's eggs, you got more snakes than you know what to do with. He who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed, a viper breaks out. Let me make sure I've got the verse that I want to come up to here. Oh, I do. Their webs will not become garments. Nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity. All right, we're talking about people, aren't we? Yes. Because does a snake sin? No, they just do what they're programmed to do. You know, and if you're in the way, move. Quick. And it's, you know, out jumping a snake strike is kind of exciting. Did it once. And I was a little guy at the time, and unfortunately it wasn't a rattlesnake. Didn't know that. It had a half a box of BBs in it when I was done. But I was walking along in the buffalo grass, and all of a sudden I heard a hiss, and I was warned to no end about rattlesnakes. I was barely 8 years old, and I hadn't seen one, so I was terrified of anything that was that I thought might be a rattlesnake. And I jumped, looked over my shoulder when I heard the hiss. It sounded like snake. And right behind my calf, that far, following it, was the snake's head, mouth wide open, reaching for my leg. I'll tell you what, my heart learned to beat faster that day. Right, it was a bull snake. And after I had dispatched it, I went and found my dad to tell him I killed my first rattlesnake. So he didn't want me killing any rattlesnakes because it was dangerous to be close to him with a BB gun. So he went down to look at it. And there it was, laying in the buffalo grass. And he said, Tom, come here and look at his tail. So he lifted it up. Feel that tail. He says, there's no rattles there. And it's a bull snake. Oh, well, what do bull snakes do? He said, they eat rattlesnakes. Oh. So next time you're out and about and you see that happen, you know, jump and then stop and look. And if it doesn't have a buzz tail, leave it alone. Also follow the laws of the state of Ohio as far as killing snakes because some of them are protected. Thank you very much. But, you know, you sometimes what it appears to be isn't what it actually is in that regard. Where was I? Oh, yeah, their webs will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity. The act of violence is in their hands. They run, their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Waiting and destruction are in their paths. Verse 8, the way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They make themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace. Our purpose is to know God's peace, to have it within us. We have the seed of it already if we have been baptized and converted, because it comes with God's Spirit. But we have to nurture it. Don't go killing good peace. You know, that bull snake was a good snake. After that, we were very careful about bull snakes. They could pretty well hang out around the house, and we're glad for that. We would keep track of them. Of course, they would eat baby chickens, but normally they would eat rattlesnakes. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 6, just a few pages on. Isaiah and Jeremiah were marvelous prophets. Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet. You can read, I think it's chapter 8 or is it chapter 9? 9 and verse 1. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night. That's why he's called the weeping prophet. He cried a lot. He cried for Israel. Could have made country and western lyrics out of Jeremiah's statements like that. Cried a sea of tears or what have you. Chapter 6, and we want to begin looking down in verse 13 of Jeremiah 6. Because of the least of them, this is talking about impending destruction coming upon Jerusalem from the north. To explain why, Jeremiah was the prophet during the time of the last kings of the house of Judah. He got to work for one good king in his early years. That was Josiah. And then Josiah's sons and nephews weren't good kings at all. The last one was Zedekiah. Zedekiah left Jeremiah in a dungeon in the palace when Nebuchadnezzar's troops broke through the gates and came and hid. And by that time, some friends of Jeremiah, one of the servants of the king who was from Africa, he had managed to get a group of men, and they lifted him up out of it. Was down in a cistern. You imagine being down in a cistern that might have a taller ceiling than this room does. And he was in the mire and the mud because the wall, you know, kind of makes a mushy mud at the bottom of it. They stored water in those places. You know, during the rainy season, they would fill them up. Well, this one was empty, and Jeremiah was stuck down in that mud, and they fished him up out of the mud. But that's where he was. So Jeremiah had to go through a lot, and we can appreciate, therefore, how God inspired him to give us these words of wisdom in verse 13 of chapter 6. Because from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. From the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They have also healed the hurt of my people slightly, barely, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Saying, peace, peace, where there is no peace. That's where the world is. But that's not where we are. We are where there is peace. That's why we're here on the Sabbath day and on the holy days. Because we seek that peace, because we already have some of it. But we need more. Now let's look at one of the key scriptures about peace that you often hear, and look how this works so that you can then look at other passages and analyze them from that perspective. Psalm 119. We're going to read the whole psalm, right? Yeah, all 172 verses or whatever. No, we're just going to read 176 verses in Psalm 119. Now we want to zero in on verse 165. So we'll back up to 161. This is the stanza that it comes in. Bear in mind, this is an acrostic poem and song. An acrostic means that each stanza starts with the successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And so verse 161 is the beginning of a stanza, and the Hebrew letter called Shin is what would be translated, is translated into a P for princes. So that's how this psalm works. That's why it's so long and why it has those funny little breaks in it. Princes persecute me without a cause, but my heart stands in awe of your word. Now this is David. I rejoice at your word as one who finds great treasure. Well, some don't think it's David, but I think it's David because it's his style. We don't know who wrote it. I hate and abhor lying, but I love your law. It's a David thing to say. Seven times a day I praise you because of your judgments. Great peace, here's the verse, great peace have those who love your law, and nothing shall offend them. If you find yourself being offended, stop just a minute. I shouldn't be offended. I should be able to understand why this is happening, because I love God's law. The more we love God's law, the more we take things in stride in life, and the stronger we become spiritually, the more God can do through us. Great peace have those who love your law, and nothing causes them to stumble, in the New King James. Nothing shall offend them in the Old King James. When somebody is offended, they're caused to stumble. So it's a concept that it ties together. So one gets it translated in the more recent version is stumble. The other one said offend. I think offend is clearer than stumble, because we don't normally in modern English think of being offended when we stumble, embarrassed, but maybe not, maybe embarrassed when you stumble, but not offended. Great peace have those who love your law. Nothing causes them to stumble. Nothing shall offend them. The stanza, when you read through that, and I'll let you do that as a little homework assignment when you have a few minutes, that's verse 161 to 168. The whole stanza applies to the church, and you'll see the overtones and how that would work. But think about the logic of it. If you love God, then you love God's law, because it's God's law. You love his law because it's his. And we love God, therefore we love his law. If you love God and you love God's law, then your mind is not on yourself, but it's on God and on his goodness, and his goodness is defined by his law. Without God's law, the world would have destroyed itself long ago. But God's law is so valuable. Now, why would traditional Christianity denounce God's law? They don't understand it. They don't understand the principle of it. Their eyes aren't open. They can't understand it right now. They are in error in the way they describe the law. Very clearly in error. But then they don't have the blessings that we have as far as coming to that understanding. The key is nothing will offend them. If your mind isn't on yourself and it's on God and his goodness, then you take things in stride. If you're more concerned about yourself, you'll tend to be offended and upset at any slight. So we mature by gaining this focus of God and his law. Because you understand God's law and you love it, you understand human weakness, including your own. So you can understand why people fall short, why the world's history is as the world's history is. If you love God's law and you understand human weakness, then you're not surprised at the sinfulness of man. So it doesn't offend you when somebody mistreats you. You take it in stride. Too bad, not pleasant, but that's life. But this is how the wisdom comes from this psalm. Bear in mind, a lot of the psalms and the verses in the psalms are like proverbs. And proverbs are like tiny little psalms. If you love God's law and you understand human weakness, you're not surprised at the sinfulness of man. God's law clearly defines his perfect spiritual character, the kind of character that you and I will build by obeying his perfect law. Now, does that mean that we can magically obey everything? No, we are human and we are fallible and we do fall short. Let us fall short shorts rather than long shorts, though. so that we come close to obeying God's law, and then that shows progress. And always understand that if you really, truly love God's law, then you're not going to be offended. You will therefore be at peace. You'll know what you're dealing with yourself. You'll understand and appreciate what others are dealing with and their situations, and you'll be at peace, more patient, more able to help and encourage and serve. Psalm 56, back a few pages into Psalm 56. Start with the first four verses. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, O God, for man would swallow me up. Fighting all day, he oppresses me. My enemies would hound me all day. For there are many who fight against me, O Most High. Whenever I'm afraid, this is a psalm of David, a Mitchum of David, one of his type of psalm. When the Philistines, this is in the superscription right above verse 1, when the Philistines captured him in Gath. Now, David is a prisoner of war at this time. Be merciful to me, O God, for man would swallow me up. Kind of haven't they? He's in jail. Fighting all day, he oppresses me. My enemies would hound me all day, for there are many who fight against me, O Most High. Whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you. Whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, I will praise his words. In God, I have put my trust. I will not fear what flesh can do to me. Great peace have they who love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. Because they do not fear what flesh can do to them. And you're like, yeah, well, the flesh could kill you. Hmm? And we have many faithful martyrs who are our ancestors in the church. Start with the 12 apostles. Throw in Stephen. That's 13. And then you can start adding the list on of the truly converted ones of old who have died in the faith. Now, we don't necessarily eagerly anticipate that or desire that, but it might be some of us will. Fine. Great peace have they who love your law, and nothing will offend them. We have the inner peace to face whatever God brings our way. Now, we can apply that very practically in our lives daily, brethren, taking things in stride and not being upset. Also, verse 11. In God I have put my trust. I will not be afraid of what man can do to me. Sort of summarizes what the early part of that psalm said. Now we go back to John. We're nearing our end here. The apostle, back to the writing of John, chapter 14, and what Christ said about having peace of mind, that godly peace of mind, that inner peace. John 14 would be during the final Passover. They kept the final Old Testament Passover by eating the lamb and all the accoutrements. And when that was over, the supper being ended, then Christ instituted the first New Testament Passover. And they had their feet washed. They had a piece of the broken bread symbolizing his body. They had the tiny sip of wine symbolizing his shed blood to come before that 24-hour period was over. So then he entered into a teaching session, which we always have during the Passover service. After we have done the symbols, then we go to the teaching session and cover many of the things that Christ covered. So we're going to look at verse 27. Start in verse 25, give yourself context. These things I have spoken to you while being present with you, but the Helper, the Holy Spirit, which the Father will send in my name, it doesn't say he. This is translated with the bias of the Trinity, and the Trinity is a false doctrine. It will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all things I said to you. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. Not as the world gives do I give you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. God gives us peace. With peace comes courage. But it's an inner peace that enables us to follow God and to serve him and do his work. Final passage is in Philippians 4. Philippians chapter 4. first six verses of Philippians 4. And it's very interesting. Therefore, my beloved and longed for brethren, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, beloved. That's what he thought of the Philippian church. You know, Philippi, was that in Macedonia or in Greece? I think it's in Macedonia. But this was the congregation he loved to go to. They were, you know, a joy for Paul. Some of the other ones were problems. Look at Corinth, for an example. Sometimes the Galatians, as we already covered. But here is Philippi. And the brethren there are just, you know, they've got a lot of it together. But are they perfect? No. No. They still have a lot of God's inner peace. Verse 2. I implore Euodia, and I implore Syntyche. Those are women's names. So here are two of the leading ladies, maybe deaconesses, I don't know, in the congregation. I implore Syntyche and Euodia to be of the same mind in the Lord. I won't always be arguing. You know, be in the same mind. I urge you also, true companion, help these women. The companion would have been the ministerial assistant, the man maybe he left to be the pastor while Paul was gone. These women who labored with me in the gospel, and with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are written in the book of life. So here we have brethren who have their challenges, but they were a great source of encouragement to the apostle. Rejoice in the Lord always. And I will say again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. Your gentleness, not your harshness, not your hard riding or galloping across people's tender feelings, but your gentleness. Let it be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And what will happen? And the peace of God, which surpasses understanding. This is the peace of God. The peace of God, which surpasses understanding, will guard your hearts and mind through Christ Jesus. That's the godly peace of mind that we want to develop, brethren. It will resolve most of the troubles we face as a congregation or as a part of an organization of God's church. It will also resolve a lot of the challenges and troubles that you yourself face, because whatever other ones come, you'll be much stronger and better equipped to deal with them. Much stronger. The world is in turmoil, brethren. The world does not know the way to this kind of peace. We know the way to godly peace and to God's inner peace. So let's go there.